Welcome to Hollywood, Minnesota, the show that looks at the links between the land of 10,000 lakes and the motion picture industry. This show aims to highlight the way cinema is a part of Minnesota's artistic and cultural heritage through interviews with local filmmakers and film festival coordinators, as well as profiles of Hollywood figures with Minnesota roots. On today's edition of Hollywood, Minnesota, I will be speaking to Mike Levy of Crescendo Productions, a Minnesota-based production company. In this interview, Levy discusses his body of work, which includes European art films and human rights documentaries. Mike, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you, Nathan.
Why don't you tell me a little bit about Crescendo Productions? How did you form the company, and what kinds of films have you produced?
We started in the mid-70s. It seemed important to have an organizational name to partner with other groups, to get grants, and, of course, to protect from liability lawsuits. So I could say and do things that people might not always like too much. And I chose the name Crescendo because it starts small and it gets bigger. And it also has a musical connotation, which I've always found close to film. Film and music just go so well together. And the kind of films I've been interested in have to do with human consciousness and how that works through different forms of artistic expression and, in particular, social change. As an objective, collective action for social change, and I found film to be a great medium for doing that kind of work.
So we're going to talk a little bit more about your current work as we go along here, but I want to start with your influences and your background. As we prepped for this interview, you mentioned that French cinema from the late 1960s spurred your interest in film. What titles were influential, and what about those films caught your interest?
Well, that was kind of interesting. When I was studying history and literature and expecting a dry and boring academic course, it turned out that one of our grad students was using film, and particularly French film, to teach what was going on in government politics and social change in France over the course of a couple hundred years. And he showed us a couple of films which I found deeply moving, like The Rules of the Game by Renoir, another one with Eric von Stroheim, La Grande Illusion, The Grand Illusion, movies like A Nous la Liberté by René Clair. These movies taught me that film can have a profound, direct relationship to other things that are going on in society. It doesn't have to be something that's separate and relegated to an artistic domain. And at the same time, I had the good fortune of seeing Pontecorvo's The Battle of Algiers, which I thought was one of the most powerful revolutionary movies of all time. I think it still sticks in my mind as something whenever I get a little despairing about the progress of social change in the world, I think of what this kind of a film can do. And on the other segment, that is altered consciousness and the mind and how it works with memory, the way Alain René's movies, Providence, Antonioni's Blow Up, Godard, Romer, Rivette Truffaut, Louis Malle, Agnès Varda. There are so many filmmakers who work in these fields. Alain Robbe-Grillet, who teaches, writes about the new novel, wrote about the new novel and made films that talk about truth and human struggle in a fascinatingly new way. It made me realize the power of film to breach our concept of what the mind and consciousness and the dream state are.
So it sounds like the French New Wave of the late 1960s was really what influenced you. In that case, what was it about those films?
I think it was the power of the image, their ability to hone in on individuals caught in difficult situations and use the technique of creative lighting, dramatic interaction, editing in a way that hadn't been done before. There were powerful documentaries, I'm thinking of not in the 60s, but going back through the period. The chronology is fascinating because you get these waves like the New Wave in France, or you get the German cinema, which came shortly after that when it swept the U.S. You get these older films, too. In the World War II period, you get Rome Open City by Rossellini. You get Los Olvidados by Buñuel. They showed raw, realistic, surrealistic, hyper-realistic in varying ways. Buñuel could be a surrealist. He could also be almost a documentary filmmaker. He went across these different genres and categories and was able to transform the effect that it has on the audience.
You spent 2 years at the London Film School. Tell me about that. What kind of memorable experiences did you have while working on student films?
Well, it was a lot of fun, obviously, to be in London. I was originally going to go to California and check out UCLA. It turned out that the head of the UCLA Film School, Colin Young, was on his way to London to start a new school called the National Film School. And I thought, that sounds pretty exciting. Cheaper, the thrill of London with everything that was going on at that time in the early 70s in London. Very exciting place. Of course, I didn't go to his school. I went to one that was considered a smaller, more technically minded school called the London Film School, where on the prospectus it says, we work in a workshop rather than an academy atmosphere. I had no idea what that meant, but it sounded good to me. Once I got there, I found out that they had people like Les Blair, Mike Lee, Lionel Baines, who were legends in the film and theater over there in London, who taught us about the idea of working as a team, you know, ensemble filmmaking, improvisation, having your film torn to shreds by your course director, and then if you still like what you did, maybe there was something to it, creating this kind of toughness and confidence with humility, which I think is the difference between going to a school where they teach you to be the auteur or the film director and the one who controls everything. This was all about working together and trying your hand at every aspect of it, almost the way you learn to be a French chef, where you can't be a French chef unless you've worked also in salad prep and sauces and desserts and ice creams and things like that. We had to work on sound and lighting and production and post-production, editing, whether we liked it or not. And that opened our eyes to how these other trades are lived by those who live it. And if you take that out, project it out to the broader picture, it makes it easier to understand how other people are living when you try to do a documentary where you're not writing the script in your head, but the people you are interested in are responsible for what you're going to see on the screen.
Early on in your career, you worked on erotic feature films, mostly with Polish director Valerian Borowczyk. You worked as an editor on Immoral Tales, released in 1974, which is a collection of four erotic stories. How did you come to this production?
The hard way. And I guess it's not easy to really get into filmmaking. Even after film school, I had to think of any possible way I could to, without being too much of a pest. Borowczyk happened to be on the jury at the Oberhausen Film Festival when I went there right as the end of film school. And a guy named Peter Cowley, who was a legendary film critic and author, said, if you want a job, I suppose it's hard to find anybody who's more supportive of young filmmakers and yet does things that are completely different than this guy, Valerian Borowczyk, and his producer, Dominique Duverger. So I went up to him, and I bugged him, and I bugged him more, and I slipped little notes into his box at the festival and wrote poetry, tried to think of clever little cute things to say, which usually didn't get me very far, but ultimately, through persistence, he said, yes, come on, join me on the set. So I started out as an assistant editor, which meant basically being absolutely silent and doing exactly what he said, handing him little strips of film, 35 millimeter film that were a couple of feet long, and knowing where each of those trims were in the bins. You know, that's the concept of film so has changed so much that few people today realize the feel of 16 or 35 millimeter film between your fingers, what it looks like when you hold a piece of film up to the light, the idea that one side of the emulsion is sticks to your tongue like a frozen doorknob in the winter, and the other side is slick and shiny. And the idea that one frame to the next, the difference is almost undetectable, but it's that little tiny difference that makes all the difference. And I would see Borowczyk spend hours on one frame to find out where to cut that. And the sound, which was running together with the picture, but only because you locked it in place. You had to clamp it down. Otherwise, the sound was loose. It was free. It was wild. It was on this magnetic tape. It could get all over the floor. It could unravel. But that was beautiful. And that's what experimental filmmaking was in those days. People were still fresh to the cinema, and they thought, why not just decouple sound from picture? Why not play around with the way we cut into this film and and slice it open. Why not paint the individual frames? All those ideas were fresh at that time, and you'd get strange and interesting combinations. So that's how I got started, and it turned out that we had a lot in common. I was probably almost as weird as he was, probably still am.
Do you think those creative opportunities came about because you went to London and then worked for this European filmmaker as opposed to going to UCLA, which apparently was your initial plan?
No doubt about it. The European approach to filmmaking is very low budget, small crews, people who have to pitch in and do whatever is required over whatever hours. And when I later went to Hollywood to try and get some work, having come back from England, my reaction was often, you went to the London Film School. Oh, there are a bunch of socialists over there. Well, we do things differently over here. So it was a completely different culture, and I really loved the culture of the European filmmaking style. And, of course, I was biased because I'd seen all these great European filmmakers and had a chance to talk to them and hang out with them a little bit, because the community there in Europe is a lot smaller in some ways, more closely knit. Of course, I suppose it's the same once you've broken into Hollywood. So it's a matter of where you are.
You continued to work with Valerian Borzyk on several other erotic films released in the 1970s and 80s, including Private Collections and The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Miss Osborne. How did working on these features prepare you for your later work?
Well, to me, these films were about philosophy, about surrealism, about social pressures, about hypocrisy, about history. So while the producers and the distributors did everything they could to market the film as erotic films or X-rated, R-rated, whatever they could get, the really interesting thing to Borowczyk and to me was the way they challenged prevailing social concepts. Almost all of his films had heroic characters in them, who were primarily women. The idea of the heroic female character in a time of repression, authoritarian dictatorship, hypocrisy, where history is written by men who had their own interests and cared little about the actual people that lived the history, whom they considered mostly animals or inhuman. I think those themes in Borowczyk's films came home to me and stuck with me. When I was traveling in Turkish Kurdistan with my brother filming and came across a young shepherd boy riding on a horse near Mount Ararat, and his foot was just black, covered with black tar. And I thought, well, that's really interesting, what's going on here. So we chatted, and I took some films, and later on found out that talking to a Kurdish child was really a crime in Turkey in those days. And so the idea of getting to know the people who are portrayed as terrifying creatures, you know, that we're supposed to be afraid of, really have beautiful stories. And I remember the police would take us and say, we're going to lock you into the police station overnight for your protection, because these Kurds are so dangerous, and we really have to watch out for them. And later on, you know, the next morning, they would come over singing and playing music, and I would record their music, and we would have a wonderful time.
Well, there's one more question I wanted to ask you about your erotic films from the 1970s that you worked on. They're distinct from what people today would refer to as pornography. So looking back at the erotic films produced in that period, what do you think was special about them, and why do you think that the genre of erotic film has basically disappeared?
Well, in the first part, I think that these films were simply a willingness to consider human relationships, intimacy, the human body, as almost sacred, very special, very beautiful. And in a way, these films were in praise of love, in praise of romantic relationships. And even though the forces against them were often extremely repressive and cruel and autocratic. If you take the Immortal Tales, each one shows a prevailing cultural view about romance and sexuality from that time. And just watching the way it changes over the centuries, but the theme of repression, hypocrisy, power, dominance, control, those remain. In pornography, which I really don't know much about because I'm not interested in it, and it's, you know, I find it pretty disgusting, I doubt that those are the objectives, I would say. If the objective is to show the beauty of the human body and what we as humans are capable of doing, how we can liberate ourselves and have freedom, even if there's repression all around us, we have the opportunity for freedom and dignity in our own personal relationships. I think that was present in the erotic films of those days of Borofczyk, and that was his way of working. I would say today, there's really a different feeling about, you know, we've come a long ways. Remember that the 60s was the flower power revolution, and the way I lived it was probably different from the way most of the history books describe it. And I found that the idea of love is something that you couldn't talk about during the 80s, 90s without people really laughing at you. I mean, imagine the president of a country saying, I think we have to found our foreign policy on love, honor, and respect. They'd probably say, that's funny. Go back and be a poet or something. But it actually works. It starts revolutionary movements of nonviolent social change.
Let's turn now toward your work on politics and human rights, which has defined most of your career. In the 1970s, you spent time in Turkish Kurdistan and the former Yugoslavia. What were you doing there, and what did you observe about film and media in those environments?
In those days, I wanted to see what was going on in the rest of the world, because it's pretty hard to know from reading the papers and watching television. So I traveled when I could to places where I knew there was some tension. And one of the actors I had worked with in film school, named David Markham, who had worked on a Truffaut film called Day for Night, was supposed to be in my diploma film, and unfortunately he had to cancel at the last minute, and he was very apologetic. So he said, to make up for not being there, I'll show you why I'm not going to be there. And he took me to the headquarters of Amnesty International, which was a tiny warehouse in the banana market in London, in Covent Garden. And I saw really a different way of working on for social change. And he was headed off to Moscow to meet secretly with dissidents in a forest outside of Moscow, a rather dangerous thing to do in those days. And so I had to respect what he was up to. So when I went to Turkish Kurdistan and some of these other places, former Yugoslavia, which was at that time well before the ethnic unrest in Kosovo that resulted in the whole breakup, you know, with the war, Kosovo war and so forth, I felt that if I could get closer to some of the people there and see what was going on and document the way of life, then there would be a way of telling history in a more holistic way, the way that grad student that I had studied under, who taught history through film. I realized the power of what film could bring. So, you know, you take your chances, and it didn't usually last too long until they find out what I'm up to and say, I think it's time for you to leave, or haul us in for some interrogation. And that was just the beginning, you know, realizing that you can document, you can record, and you can witness. The camera can witness. The camera can assist documentation. And I think that's been the main thing. We cannot allow history to be written by those same ruling elites who wish to perpetrate their views on the general population. So we have to reclaim our history. What better way than through film, storytelling, and writing?
So you've shot in places like Haiti, Cairo, Gaza, and Iraq. What kind of organizations have you worked with, or have you done this independently?
Yeah, it's funny to talk about being in somewhere like Gaza when you see what's going on now, where the media will give you one image of what the situation is there and what the priorities are. They will omit usually the kind of personal detail that shows the humanity behind the suffering. the idea of the perforated eardrums from the explosions of the children who can't sleep at night, the idea of how these weapons that are being used can maim and burn and split apart parts of the body. We don't see any of that. We don't see what it's like to not have anywhere to sleep, where there's running water or electricity or a toilet or a hospital that has the facilities. So I went to Gaza with Code Pink because I was really upset with what had been happening in the cast lead operation, which resulted in so many civilian deaths and so many children being maimed. And our idea was we were going to build playgrounds in Gaza, which was a very dangerous and controversial thing that was probably in violation of the siege of Gaza. So the idea of being there and hearing the stories of the people and seeing the faces of the children and watching them trying to deal with their trauma, that was pretty exciting. Same thing in Haiti. It's one thing to say there are 1,000 prisoners in the National Penitentiary, which has a capacity for, let's say, half of that. But then when you go in there, or you go into a small detention center, and you have your camera hidden inside a bag, and you're hoping that the commanders aren't going to see it, and you see somebody being tortured in front of your eyes, or you see hands reaching through the bar. You know, I'm haunted by this hands reaching through the prison bars, grasping on, trying to touch me as I walk by, to hand me a little slip of paper with their name on it so that they can exist. Because without their name, they don't exist. I was walking through the central part of Port-au-Prince during a demonstration. This was in 1986, shortly after Duvalier had been kicked out by the people. And the man leading the demonstration would lead the people in various chants. We happened to walk by the prison there. And as we walked by the prison, the prisoners would leap from the ground up to the bars, which were too tall for the feet to touch the ground. But they could hold the bar with their two hands for a while, as long as their muscles would carry them. And we could see their hands. And so I shouted out to them. I said, tell me your name, tell me your name, because I had the camera running. And I thought, I at least know who some of these people are, and we could then advocate for them. And just as I did that, I noticed that the police who were in front of it started to pull out their guns, and they were pointing them at us. So if I'd been a little bit more, smart, I would have said, okay, I think it's time to go. But I didn't quite realize what was going on. It was only later, when I looked through the footage, that I saw a man in a white headband running towards that policeman, tackling to the ground as he had pulled out his gun and was aiming it directly at me. So I didn't even realize that this guy had done such a heroic deed. And I thought, this is the difference between this kind of witnessing and documentation of film and the combining human rights work with advocacy work with film. There have to be ways to bring about the kind of collective change that I've been talking about and that so many other people are working for. So Code Pink, Amnesty International, Physicians for Human Rights, a number of other human rights organizations and democracy movements in Haiti and with the Kurds. Those are what kind of nourish me and keep me going.
Some of your work has been done in secret, and you've engaged in clandestine filmmaking in prisons and similar places. How do you go about shooting in a covert way, especially since film equipment can be very bulky?
It used to be incredibly bulky. When I went to Haiti in 86, of course, it was the professional Betacam, which is about as long as your arm. Not exactly lightweight when you're carrying it around in the street for hours and hours. So that was a pain, and I had a great crew guy named Pablo from downtown community TV, DCTV in New York, who was doing sound. And we basically were able to assert our presence and be open about it in enough ways so that we would get some respect. Often people are afraid to do something really terrible to you. If you are confident about what you're doing and you are open about it, the idea would be to get their permission, their authorization, because they probably think they are not doing anything wrong. But there are times when you have to be much more inconspicuous, and fortunately, we have these very small cameras now. And I even had a fax machine that was would fit in the palm of my hand that had a little bit of tiny bit of paper, and I could go into some notorious torturer's office and just sort of roll the little fax machine over a paper when he wasn't looking and didn't even look at or doing anything, record that, and then I would just keep a tiny hole in a little bag, and the little tiny camera would be going all the time, and I would just hope that I was getting it the right way. There was a guy named Bob Fulton who taught at Harvard a film course. He was from Denver, about documentary filmmaking where you don't even look through the camera. And it was the most beautiful, rhythmic thing. It combined melody, music, African culture, and so forth. And some of that same technique where you kind of allow the camera to sense where it is that it needs to be. And sometimes you get just somebody's feet, and sometimes you get what's really important in the picture.
When you're looking at projects or shoots, are there underlying philosophical ideas or principles that underscore which jobs you work on?
I think it's pretty much the same as when I started out film school. It's the idea of solidarity, is the idea of honoring the people that you're working with, doing it in a collaborative sense as much as possible. There are some really beautiful projects that are happening now that you can see, like the Idle No More Native American movement has produced some fantastic films that I saw recently at the Palm Springs Native Film Festival. The principles of empowerment, which is, as the Haitians have a word, they say encadrement, which is to, in a way, be a kind of framing, supportive presence that leverages the voices of those people who have no voice, whose voices are cut off. That's the kind of project that I like to be involved in, and it's when dealing with cultures that are not the same as my own, I think of what is the responsibility of our culture? What is our government's responsibility? What role have we played historically? How can we honor history and those who have lived it? Those principles are really very simple, and it becomes a kind of spiritual commitment that I think works really well now in this time of crisis when people are suffering the same kinds of patterns of repression and struggling in the same way.
It seems that the documentary genre has exploded at the same time that the popularity of old media, and particularly newspapers and network newscasts, has declined. Why do you think audiences have responded to documentary films?
That's a really good question. I don't know. Perhaps it's because people are fed up with being lied to by the media, lied to either overtly through propaganda that's sent out to them, or omission of the other side of the story. The other thing that's really disturbing about what forces people to watch documentaries that have a bit more edge to them, some of these newer documentaries, is the idea that the voices that are allowed onto the mainstream media, which is your source for information and news, let's say, even on the internet to a certain extent, it's the voices from the edge, which are largely excluded, except in the rare case when it's done with humor, like on Bill Maher or on Colbert Report. Now, those aren't documentaries, but they are still providing information. The kind of advocacy documentary that you see these days, which is also very helpful, is a way to provoke people's thinking. And at times, they are lacking in what you would say the kind of scientific research rigor that is necessary, historical accuracy, fact-based documentary. That's what I think really makes something compelling, is when you no longer have to say it's simply one person's opinion or the filmmaker taking control of the medium, but there's a lot more factual reporting that's done through documentaries these days. You know, people like Robert Greenwald, well, he did a film with Amnesty International called The Forgotten Prisoners, and it was interesting to see him on the set, that he was happy to have someone from Amnesty there, which I happened to have that job at that time, to help see that he is being true to the way things are done inside a Turkish prison and Turkish human rights situation. So I think that we are learning we still have a long way to go. We are learning to be critical thinkers when it comes to film and our appreciation of how we get our information. And that's what some of these new documentaries provide us.
Over the years, you've been involved in some film festivals. In the early 80s, you curated a circuit of U.S. art house presentations of films from the International Festival of Women's Films. You've also been involved with the Walker Arts Center and the Independent Filmmaker Project. What have you been doing with these organizations?
The group in France, there were two women, Jackie Buet and Elizabeth Treillard. They're still going today, and they decided that women's voices were not heard enough in film. And most people thought, well, there aren't many films made by women these days. So they organized these festivals in a suburb of Paris for a number of years and invited really amazing talents whose films probably didn't have much hope for commercial release. And so I thought, these films need to be seen more. So I asked if I could borrow some of them and take them around the United States and show them in art houses. So we have people like films from Giselle Cavalli, Marlene Gorris, Agnieszka Holland, who's quite well-known, Helke Sander, and, of course, Margarita von Trotta is very well-known. And the festival in France, they have these people, some of whom you heard a lot about later and some you didn't, but they were voices of the time that were showing a side of culture and society that people weren't getting to see otherwise. So it's, the once again, the same idea. And what was cool about the Walker and the University Film Society, which with it now it's the Minneapolis-St. Paul International Film Festival and Film in the Cities in the old days and Intermedia Arts and Minneapolis Cable Television Network, all these organizations helped to bring together the film community. The fun part for me was to get to meet people like the legendary Abel Goff from France, who made the film Napoleon so long ago, who's films are still exciting and need to be seen by new audiences, or Rob Grier or Franju, Wim Wenders, Werner Schroeter, they all came to the Twin Cities, and I loved having the opportunity to just talk to them, find out what they were thinking, and work with them. So there is really a lot going on in Minnesota, even though I live across the border and don't get to be as much a part of it as I'd like to.
Last question I'd like to ask you. What does Minnesota filmmaking scene have to offer?
There may be a difference between the filmmaking scene itself, with so much going on that may or may not be known to the general public, and then what gets out. There are screenings that are done regularly by all these organizations, the Minnesota Film Board, the University Film Society, and the Festival, the Walker Arts Center, and many other places. And, of course, the universities and colleges who are showing a lot of the new filmmaking that's being done in film and video, short film, music films. There's a collaborative relationship between the music and film and acting, theater, so forth. All of these related arts are feeding, I think, each other. What I'd love to see is greater encouragement, support, facilitation for more screenings, more distribution opportunities for these new films, and especially now that we have the options for internet distribution. And there are people who have been really successful who have come back and have taught people how they can market their films and contribute their time to help encourage young people to get started and get going and realize what to expect and what to watch out for in the film business. So I think it's a very healthy film business and a film community, which, as long as it continues to support its members, will continue to plant seeds for the future, which I think is a great thing.
That concludes this edition of Hollywood, Minnesota. Thank you to Mike Levy of Crescendo Productions for speaking with me today. This program is made possible by a grant from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. I'm Nathan Wardinsky, and be sure to join me next week for another edition of Hollywood, Minnesota.